Blog Talk Radio.
It's time.
Yeah. Blog Talk Radio. And now it's time for Navajo Nation Politics on the Navajo Nation. And this show is sponsored by Town and Design. And now, let's go to your host, Marlon Shabon.
And I'm your host once again for Blog Talk Radio, Politics on the Navajo Nation. Yate'e, Marli Shabala, Yin Shia, Tohe Glini Ashlon, just a net, Bashis Chin. And I'm so happy to be here once again this Wednesday, and we are broadcasting from live from the business of Blue Sage Tea, or it's actually Blue Sage Soap. So Blue Sage Tea or Blue Sage Soap. And I want to thank them for letting me host this show from their business. And just to let you know a little bit about Blue Sage Soap. They're from the Greek Islands. And they you can find them on www.ebay.com. And so actually, their internet connection is so much better than where I'm at, and so I'm really grateful because you can hear us more clearly. We can see also who's calling in, and I want to encourage the callers to please call in. I want to hear from the people who have been attending the Navajo Nation presidential forums, and the phone number to call is 347-989-0048. That number again is 347-989-0048. And again, I am hosting the show with Sharon Mays, and she's my co-host, and she's a former radio broadcast journalist. And she was out here on the Navajo Reservation during the 1989 political turmoil. She was reporting from Gallup, Mexico. So she has a good deal of experience in radio, and I really appreciate that. I'm mainly into print. And we'll be hearing from news from the northern part of the Navajo Reservation from news reporter Noelle Smith, and she works for the Farmington, New Mexico Daily Times. And, of course, we'll have Bill Donovan on the show, and he'll be bringing us some updates or, you know, making his comments about the Navajo Nation political campaign. And he works for the Gallup Independent as an editor, and he's also a correspondent for the Navajo Times newspaper. And so I'd like to open up the show right now once again. If we have callers out there, please call us. You know, I haven't been able to attend the presidential forums, but from what I read and comments that I'm receiving, it's been people are kind of disappointed. The questions aren't that strong for the political presidential candidates, and at times they feel that the presidential candidates aren't really answering the questions. But, you know, I'd like to hear from the people that have been attending the presidential forums. So please call 347-989-0048. And I've been busy this past week and also last week, starting with the Asahi Lake fire, which is near Navajo, New Mexico, and also that area is beautiful. It's right below the Chuska Mountains. There's a lot of pine and sage, and it's just beautiful country. You have lakes out there. That's why it's called the Asahi Recreational Area. And there was a fire that was out there, and it started on June 13th. And one of the issues that actually came from this Asahi Lake fire was some controversy regarding the donations that were being received and being sent to the evacuees and also to the firefighters. And there was a a statement that was issued by President Ben Shelley regarding what was going on with those donations. And Sharon, you're more familiar with that statement. I was out there, you know, visiting the chapters and also, you know, going to the daily fire updates and letting people know what was going on via my blog and Facebook and Twitter. And so just before the show started, you were reading a portion of that statement to me. Why don't you go ahead and share that with our listeners?
Well, I think, you know, this statement that was put out by the
Navajo President's Office addressed, you know, the supplies, because for the last 2 days, Facebook basically just went crazy over situations where people were saying that members of the President's Office were coming and taking some of those donations, and the President wanted to, I guess, address that. And he talked about, it says that the Southwest Incident Area Management Team 3 is a self-contained mobile unit responding to fires across the Southwest, and they have their own equipment, supplies, food, and other necessities provided for them. And he says, quote, if any of you attended any of these meetings, you will have heard them say time and again that the donations are a great gesture, but they are already taken care of. They ask that the donations be provided to families affected by the fire. This is what we have done, end quote. And then he went on to say that, quote, you must also recognize that a lot of the negative comments that are posted on Facebook are from bogus accounts from anonymous individuals. How can such posts from phony individuals and supposed organizations be taken seriously? And he goes on to say that this fire is an unfortunate event, but as leaders, we have responded quickly to the emergency. So there was also a statement put out by Rose Whitehair, who is on part of the Navajo Nation Department of Emergency Management. And I was just looking at their Facebook page, and I thought it was interesting that the most recent post said, despite the negative social media discord, we are still actively delivering the best services to our impacted communities, end quote. So,
well, the issue over the donations, I spoke with Rose Whitehair this morning, and this morning was the last fire update that was given by the Southwest Incident Management Team, and they're an interagency group that comes in and provides outside resources to the local firefighters to help them assist with wildland fires that have gone beyond their control, gone beyond their resources. And she said that there was a message on Facebook specifically by an individual, and I'm trying to track it down, but this individual said he went to one of the shelters and that there was no food and he was going to start cooking there, and that President Shelley had or staff had come in and taken the food, but there was no, I'm a news reporter, and there was no confirmation of that statement. And then KOB TV station, which is out of Albuquerque, had a news story about a individual who had come from Albuquerque, and she's a well-known individual. She's like called the coupon lady. You know, she collects all kind of coupons. You probably know more about that than I do, Sharon. But she came out to one of the shelters also, and she wanted to donate and help out. And she thought that there were her donations, that there were other people that had donated. But when she got to the shelter, there were no donations, and she was started also questioning what was happening to the no donations. So you had this Facebook post, and then you had this individual from Albuquerque call KOB TV station. And then the reporter from KOB didn't come out and talk to Rose Whitehair, who is the head of the Navajo Nation Emergency Team. And that was the Navajo Nation Emergency Operations Center. And that that center brought together all of these different groups, the Division of Health. They brought in Indian Health Service Hospital. They also had individuals from Navajo Division of Transportation. They had, they brought in a lot of people and worked as a team. And today, I was with them. I followed them as they loaded up the donations that were collected at Fort Defiance Chapter. And Fort Defiance Chapter has an area that is temperature controlled. And that means that the food and whatever is in there is stored at a specific temperature, which keeps it really nice. And so they loaded up water practically up to the ceiling. They had paper goods. They had personal hygiene products. They had blankets. They had, what else did I see there? I saw sleeping bags. I saw dog food. I saw Gatorade. There was just a lot of donations. It was amazing. It was good to see this outpouring of assistance from all these individuals. I'm not sure where they're from, but I'm going to see if I can track that down. And so they loaded all of that up, these volunteers, well, they're tribal employees, but they were pulled in from their different work sites, and they took it and they dropped it off at Sheep Springs. And it was hot today. And they were, this is men and women. And they were picking up those cases of water. They're picking up the potatoes. They're picking up the dog food, these huge cartons of paper goods and food, and just, taking it into the Sheep Spring Chapter. And then they went to Nosh Chitty, and then they were going to Tohatchee. And then yesterday they were actually had gone up to Newcomb and dropped off some of the donations. I mean, there were just huge amount of donations. So what I saw there in the Fort Defiance Chapter, that was all taken and delivered out to the people. So getting back to the KOB news reporter, he went out yesterday and was he took a video of the donations. He followed them out when they delivered them, and he apologized to Rose Whitehair and her crew for publishing that story, broadcasting that story without confirming it first and finding out what exactly had happened. And that was that you don't do that as a journalist. And the reason I started tracking down what happened is because I was attending these meetings, these fire updates, and there were individuals from the president's office that were coming up to me and telling me, I thought you journalists worked on facts. These are the facts, Marley. And I was like, oh, yeah, okay, cool. That's wonderful. And one thing, though, that Rose said to me and the public information officers is that they had no problem with my reporting. And I appreciated that. But I still get the fallout from other media sources. And Rose was also upset about some local news reporting. And it didn't come from me. It didn't come from the Gallup Independent. But there was a report, and we saw it last week, I think, Sharon, if you remember, that there were 17 summer camps that had burned based on an anonymous Navajo Nation police officer. Well, it wasn't true. And so these families that were evacuated from those homes were in additional distress. They didn't know if it was their camp. They had livestock there. I mean, you're talking about having your home burned down with all of your personal items and also those that have been handed down to you. And not only that, so many of them were just taken so quickly that they weren't able to get everything that they wanted. They really did not, there was no understanding because it has never happened before. There's never been a fire of this magnitude up in the Chuska Mountains and impacted those families. And so on top of being evacuated and to get some of those news reports, it just added to the stress. And so, you know, there are times, yeah, our tribal government is not at its best behavior. But, you know, for our listeners, they need to understand that it didn't happen this time. I went out to Sheep Springs and I talked to the elected officials there. And they were so grateful for getting information from the fire information officers, for the work that was being done by Rose Whitehair's group, the Emergency Operations Center. And I just want to make sure that people understand that and what's been happening.
I think that perhaps why some of the misconception or the misunderstanding happened was because they saw people moving the supplies and moving it to Fort Defiance, and they were concerned that people who were impacted would have to travel so far just to get it. But I don't think they realized that there were going to be deliveries made. And you're right, Marley, it is quite, I mean, just heart-moving to realize that so many people donated, not just in our area, but from what I understand, it came from all over the country. People were coming in, just like the coupon lady. There were a number of, you know, people who did that. They, you know, instead of, you know, keeping those supplies for themselves, they donated them, you know, for here. And the point is well taken, too, that, you know, I don't think people realize that the Fort Defiance area, chapter does have the climate control room where they could keep these supplies fresher. And you're right, it has been hot. But, you know, kudos to them. It's just, you know, it's amazing how, you know, one thing can happen and, you know, somebody sees something and then they perhaps didn't understand. And, again, people saw things being moved out and then moving to Fort Defiance. And I think that kind of goes along with the constant thing that we have here in Window Rock. You know, Window Rock is always seen as getting everything because so much of the general fund's budget, 80%, is spent here. And so, you know, you can understand how someone would be a little bit upset or perhaps maybe think, oh, great, you know, they're getting it again. And, you know, so many of the outlying areas are not properly supplied or you know, they don't get, you know, the funds or you know, the things that we get here in Window Rock. And, you know, that's all administration, that money that's spent here. So, you know, that Window Rock has that history. Fort Defiance has that history. So you can kind of, you know, perhaps understand why or how, you know, that misunderstanding could have happened.
The donations, though, they were, you know, to let our listeners understand, they were delivered out to the communities that were impacted, and that was Newcomb had a shelter, so there were some of the donations that were delivered there. Sheep Springs is right below the Tushka Mountains. They're right by the road that goes through Narbona Pass, and that was closed as soon as the fire started because it was very dangerous. And then you had that was through, and it just recently opened that road. Just, you know, for our listeners, if you weren't aware of that, and then they went further down south with more of the donations to Nas Chitty chapter, and I had taken some photos of Nas Chitty at Nas Chitty, and you could see the smoke behind it. When I went to Sheep Springs last Monday, which was the 16th. It was really smoky. It was like a haze was out there. And then Tohatchee, of course, is also below the Tushka Mountains. So those are the communities that received the donations. And I'll be posting photos and also a video. But we have a caller right now, so I'm going to see if I can't get them on the line right here. Okay, here we go. Hello, can you hear me? We have a caller. Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
Hello.
Would you like to make a comment, share, whatever you want?
Marley, it's Noelle.
Oh, Noelle. Oh, I didn't even recognize your phone number. Hey, Noelle, it's our Farmington Daily Times news reporter, and I'm going to go ahead and let her talk to us about some of her stories. So what are you going to be talking about? I know you were out there talking with some of the firefighters. In fact, I got an email, and your story about the wildland firefighter that you interviewed was given an additional push by the Navajo Nation Emergency Operations Center, and they were saying that, you know, out of everything that was happening, that there is a ray of sunshine, and that was your story, Noelle.
Right. That is the story I wrote that was printed in our Saturday edition on Friday, the 20th, I think it was. Gallup independent reporter Arlissa Bicenti were allowed access to the northern rim of the fire area. And so based on that tour and also the interviews we conducted on the mountaintop, I wrote the story for Saturday and included comments that we received from an individual named Dana. I'm going to probably mispronounce her last name, but hold on. I gotta find my story. I printed out all my stories, so I have to find it. But I remember her first name was Dana. Give me a few seconds. Bagnoli, and she was situated at a drop point station on Navajo Route 30, which is the dirt road that leads to the top of the Chuska Mountains from the New Mexico Highway 134, and that Navajo Route 30 travels all along the mountaintop, goes into Mexican Springs. And, you know, we talked to her about what was going on as far as the firefighting activity and how they were going out and, you know, trying to contain the fire. And at the time that we visited, the crews out there were mopping up hot spots on the fire's eastern, western, and northern edges and doing some tree cutting. So these trees that aren't stable because of the fire won't, you know, injure people when they reopen the area. And so she explained that process. And we were also allowed to interview one of the firefighters, and her name is Beulah Woody, and she's a strike team crew boss trainee with the Bureau of Indian Affairs Division of Forestry and Wildland Fire Management. And among her duties there was coordinating the travel and placement of water engines, and she's originally from Mexican Springs. And she helped out with the evacuations of residents the weekend of June 14th and 15th. And she told us about how thick the smoke was and the dust and how that made it difficult for them to conduct the evacuations, but they still managed to, you know, get the residents out. And the day we visited, the winds weren't as heavy as earlier in the week, so, you know, she expressed what some of the other firefighters I got to talk to during the course of this coverage was, you know, they were grateful that the wind had died down because it allowed them to get out there and really work on containing the fire, and right now, last I checked, it was 80% containment, and tomorrow the type of fire ranking it has will go from a 2 to a 3, which is good. It means, you know, the activity isn't as heavy as what it was when it first started.
Well, you know, that interview that you did with Beulah, that was, you know, I was there, and I also had a chance to talk to her. And, you know, I'm glad you were talking about what the environment was like when they had to evacuate the people. Do you remember what else how she was describing that? Because I don't think people understand, you know, because it was clear you could see the smoke, but you weren't really in there. And unless you were actually there, you know, you wouldn't know how that smoke can affect your eyes, you know, visibility and the roads up there. We went up that road, and you're familiar with it. It's a Narbona Pass Road, and that thing is pretty windy and narrow, and, I mean, it just drops off in places.
Right. So the road is like kind of a single-lane dirt road. It's rocky, and because of the lack of moisture from rainfall, it's very dusty. So, you know, if you travel, even if you travel at a slow speed, you're bound to kick up some dust here and there, and it sticks to your car, it gets into your interiors, and so when the wind comes, you add the wind to that, you know, picks up the dust, it creates a cloud of its own, and then you've got the smoke from the fire, and that's just, I'm sure, is probably as thick as fog up there. And Beulah, luckily, she's frequent that area through her work, so she was familiar with where the residencies are located, and you know, breathing in that smoke and that dust does, you know, cause some respiratory problems. I can tell you for a fact that after this week of reporting out there and breathing in what I breathe in, I ended up getting a cold and a slight scratchy throat, and that was very odd to have a runny nose in the middle of summer, but managed to get through it. And she talked about that extensively, but you know, each time they went to a residency to evacuate the people, you know, they complied with it. She didn't mention any type of coming across any type of disagreements or anything. I think people were, you know, curious about what was happening and were probably in the process of trying to get out and see where they can be evacuated to.
Well, that's for our listeners and people, because they had the roads closed off. I mean, they closed off the road between Crystal and Sheep Springs, and so there was no traffic going through there. You had to go all the way around back to Window Rock and then back, you know, over to Yautehe and then back up north again. So you were going Crystal down south, you know, and then cutting across to the east and to Yautehe, then back up north again to Tohatchee and Oshchitty, and then Sheep Springs again, and then there was Newcomb, and Shiprock also was involved. And so these communities, it was difficult on them, because when the fire broke out, and we were talking about that, you only had the Southwest Incident Management Team group out there, and the Emergency Operations Center, Navajo Nation Emergency Operations Center, hadn't started working with the people, and the initial community meetings, there was a lot of questions regarding livestock, shelters, donations, what people didn't understand is that the Southwest Incident Management Team 3 was there specifically to deal with the fire. And they come into a community and they expect to work with an emergency team also. And after a while, when President Shelley finally issued his emergency declaration, which opened the door for the Emergency Operations Center to be established and pull in all these other resources, that's when you started hearing some of these fire information officers tell community members, you know, oh, you need to call, you know, Rose Whitehair. She's handling the livestock. Call Rose Whitehair because the security, Navajo Police is working with them. You know, call Rose Whitehair regarding donations, shelters, you know, all those issues that community people had. And you had a chance to talk with her, and we're going to take a little break here, Noelle. And when we come back, if you could just share a little bit more about that, because we had talked about the issues over donations also, and we went together to the Fort Defiance Chapter House and saw that room packed with donations. So for our listeners, we're going to take a break right now, and please call in at 347-989-0048.
Blog Talk Radio, you're listening to Politics on the Navajo Nation with Marley Shabala. And now, Joe Harjo and Poetic Justice, Creation Story.
By words are circling over this house formed of calcium of blood. This house in danger of being torn apart by stones of fear. If these words can do anything, if these songs can do anything, I say bless this house with stars. Transfix us with love.
Blog Talk Radio. You're listening to Politics on the Navajo Nation, and that was Joy Harjo and Poetic Justice, Creation Story. And now, back to your host, Marley Shabala.
Yate, Marley Shabala, Yin Shia Tohe Glini Shlo, Nasht Ajest Atene Epashis Chin. And I'm here with Politics on the Navajo Nation. My co-host is Sharon Mays. And we are talking with Farmington Daily Times news reporter Noelle Smith, and she covers the northern part of the Navajo Reservation. And we've been talking about the Asai Lake fire, and it's at 80% containment, but the total acreage, as reported this morning, was 14,712 acres. And the wildland firefighting across the country is federally funded. And you had the, there's different agencies and teams that come together. The team that was out here was the Southwest Incident Management Team 3. And now they will be transferring command of the Asai Lake fire to a Type 3 management team. And that management team is going to be headed by a San Carlos and Navajo Indian man. And his name is Leon Ben Jr. And that's going to be happening at 6 a.m. tomorrow. That'll be the official time that the Asai fire will be handed from the Southwest Incident Team 3 to the Type 3 management team. And before we broke took a break in our broadcast, we were talking about the issues regarding donations. And that has received not only some local focus news reporting, but also it went into New Mexico State. But remember when we went out there to Fort Defiance and all the food and all the dry goods and even clothing and blankets that we saw over there, Noelle?
Yeah, I remember. They were stacks and stacks of bottled water, Gatorade, and they were sectioned off, so you had the beverages, and then you also had, like, medical supplies in one corner. There were bags of clothing and shoes and some household items in another area, and there was food that was divided between perishable and non-perishable, and you had personnel hygiene items, and I saw boxes of paper towels, boxes of toilet paper, even the ready-to-eat meals, and it took up the whole main section of the Fort Defiance chapter house, and I was pretty amazed at what I saw there. I thought I seen my fair share of donations when I went to the Newcomb High School Gymnasium on last Tuesday, because they had quite a bit of bottled water and food items there, but it didn't compare to what I saw at Fort Defiance Chapter House.
I know that you were going to be doing a story about the donations, that you had heard that there was some issues concerning the donations, so what were you able to find out and track down?
It was similar to what you found out, too. Monday evening, I returned home, and as I was parking my vehicle in my parking spot, Rose Whitehair, who's the director of the Department of Emergency Management for the tribe, called me, and she, first of all, she apologized for calling so late, but I told her it was fine because I understand she's, you know, quite busy. Everyone wants to receive updates from her and communicate what the latest developments are in terms of this fire and addressing the needs of the people. And she explained to me the situations that some of her personnel had encountered and the reasons why some of the donations ended up in Fort Defiance Chapter House. And she told me that the department was informed last week that the shelter set up at Tohatchee High School was going to be closing after Friday because there were no evacuees to use the facility over the past two nights. And plus the school district needed to start preparing for some summer programs they host. So she said the perishable food donations that were housed at Tohatchee were then relocated to Newcomb so it could be prepared for evacuees that were still staying there. And so non-perishable items and were taken to the Fort Defiance chapter house so they could be inventoried and also that there was adequate space to store those items. And so that's why they took them to the chapter house. And she also went into a little more about the rumors that were circulating on social media. And among those rumors that her department had to address were reports about burnt livestock, fatalities, and even that Newcomb chapter at one point was ordered to evacuate. And she said it was all false. And then she said that probably about 30% of her department's resources were spent on addressing false information and disputing rumors. And she said, you know, if you don't dispute them, they get to the point where they were on Monday afternoon, which is that the tribal officials are coming in and taking these donations. And these donations were, you know, were given to address the people's needs. And she also mentioned to me that when news about the fire started being reported and more people were finding out, they were receiving calls about donations, and she would have her personnel explain that in regards to like the Southwest Area Incident Management Team. That they don't accept donations directly. And donations made to firefighters weren't going to be accepted because they are federally funded, so the firefighters' needs and supplies are already paid for and already in route and will be given to them. While it's nice to donate food to the firefighters, there's also concerns about safety because, you never know that a food item could be tainted, and that would have consequences of its own. So, but after a while, they decided that the chapters that were impacted were points that donations could be given to. So that's when they came up with the list of you can donate to Nosh Chitty, you can donate to Sheet Springs, you can donate to Newcomb, you can donate here, and you can donate there. And the response was overwhelming, I think. And so there, later on in the week, there was that call by the Emergency Operations Center to pause in donations. So she explained all that thoroughly to me, and so it was good of her to call me and give me this explanation, because I know there were a lot of people wondering where are these donations going to and why are they all of a sudden disappearing from the impacted chapters.
Well, when I talked with her also, she said that Tohatchee had, which was a shelter, had asked if they could shut down because there weren't any more evacuees, and they were also preparing for summer school because Tohatchee was using its schools as evacuation centers, and the same for Newcomb. They weren't they weren't getting any evacuees anymore, and so they said that they needed to also get ready for their summer school programs. Did she talk to you about that too?
Right, yeah, she said the same thing about both schools. She had mentioned that Tohatchee was the one to contact her department and say, tell them that we don't have any evacuees staying here any longer and we need to get the facility ready to start these summer school programs. And the same thing with Newcomb. I know they resumed their summer school on Tuesday, And after shutting down last Tuesday, and the reason why they had to shut down last Tuesday was because they were concerned with the smoke, the levels of smoke that was going through the community, and they, I think it was like midway through Tuesday, they decided to cancel the rest of the summer class for that day and ask parents to come and pick up their students to take them home because they were concerned about the students breathing in the smoke. And then later on, they had to cancel the rest of the summer school session for the week because they had evacuees come in and stay in the new gymnasium. And they were also using the high school and the elementary school to accommodate the firefighters, and that's where the East Spike Camp was established. So you had the elementary school was being used to provide meals, breakfast and dinner to the firefighters, and they were also given sack lunches to take with them when they were out in the field. And I was there last Wednesday. That's why I didn't call in, because we were doing a story about the firefighters. And when we arrived at Newcomb Elementary School on Wednesday afternoon, we were informed that the firefighters won't be returning until the evening to have their dinner and then go back to the high school, and that's where they were sleeping, and you know, they were free to do, you know, check in at home and or just take showers or relax and then go to bed and resume activities in the morning. So, and when we had returned on Wednesday evening, we met up with a support team from the Navajo Scouts, and we met their leader, and her name is Tina, and she explained that the group she was working with are fire trained, but right now they were serving as the support team for the firefighters who were going up on the mountain. So their duties were getting the meals ready, and they didn't cook the meals actually there in at the elementary school. The meals were being prepared at Fort Defiance and then delivered to Newcomb Elementary. So once the delivery was made, then they would receive these like big boxes and they unload it. And I was curious what was inside, like how was the meal gonna be. And she they open the boxes and they pull out these big white food containers, and that's what they would use to serve the firefighters. And so the night we were there, it was chicken. So they had, I think it was like chicken and garbanzo bean soup, and they even had tofu for those who are vegetarian, and also the sides and bread. And so that support team was, you know, there to get the food ready and do the service. And so as the teams moved in, the first thing they would do is they would go straight to the bathroom, clean up, and then remain with their units and come in, get their food service, sit down and eat. And it was just like this well-groomed machine that I saw happening, and it was pretty cool. And I talked to a couple of the crew bosses, and they seemed to have similar statements. I mean, they told me the conditions on the mountain had been better on that Wednesday, and what kind of activities they were doing, and also that they really appreciated the amount of support they were getting from the communities. You know, if it was people coming up to them, maybe when they were in Newcomb, saying thank you to the signs, the homemade signs you saw along the roads and the communities, which were like, thank you, firefighters, and, you know, thank you for your work, thank you for saving the mountain. And they really appreciated that. And I also saw, you know, some donated bottled water and Gatorades were also being given to the firefighters. And they, when we were at Newcomb Elementary School, their cafeteria has a stage. And so we saw these large orange buckets that you see at Home Depot they sell, and those were filled with ice, and they had bottled water in there. And so that was how one part of the donations were being used.
Well, you know, talking about the meals that were taken to the wildland firefighters, we were sitting in the kitchen, remember, at the command center in Fort Defiance, and they had a I could smell hamburgers. And they had all those tables set up. I mean, and that's what they usually have. They have that's what the team is. They have people that come in their own traveling kitchen. I mean, it's amazing what they have and what they serve these firefighters, because they need that. They need the really good food, and they have the water there for them, coffee, juice. It's cafeteria style. And when you're talking about well groomed, the firefighters, they do. They just don't all, you know, whoever's ready, just walk into the cafeteria and sit down and start eating. They go in as a crew, and then they try to finish up and also leave as a crew. But when they're there, they stick together, and it's paramilitary. And I think our listeners who are military understand that that mm-hmm. if you're with your unit, you know, you stay with your unit no matter what. If you're in whatever it is that you're doing, you're on assignment, and these firefighters, they were on assignment. And I know that sometimes community members want to share their experiences with them, take them out sightseeing, but what are the hours that they told you they're keeping?
From what I was told from the guy who was the representative from the Southwest area management team, he said that their typical day, well, they were about, on June 18th, which was last Wednesday, there were about 250 firefighters at that East Spike Camp in Newcomb. And so they start their day at 5 a.m. and usually end their day at 10 p.m. And they're up on that mountain for a majority of that time. And one of the things I remember about that visit was the 20 gallons of coffee that was typically being brewed that morning, those mornings that they were there. And the guy we talked to, his name was Aaron, and he showed us one of those what a 20-gallon coffee maker looks like, and it looks like a small metal garbage can. And I was just like, are you sure that's the actual coffee maker, or was it just converted or what? And he's like, no, that's the coffee maker. And he showed us the coffee filter, and the coffee filter was, oh, gosh, as big as a hubcap, I would say. It was pretty big, and him and the photographer I went with, his name is John Austria, they joked around and said you could cut a hole in the center of the coffee filter and pull it over your head, and it looked like that collar that you see Shakespeare wearing. So they chuckled about that. But I was like, 20 gallons of coffee, and Aaron was like, oh, and they'll go through it. These guys will clear it, you know. 20 gallons is nothing. And I'm, you know, coming from a newsroom, coffee's popular in a newsroom, but I don't think a newsroom could finish 20 gallons of coffee.
But you know what? I think that if there's ever a conference where you have Navajo people, I was at a conference where the staff at this hotel actually cut the Navajo people off. They said no more coffee. They I don't know how much the people there had consumed, but all of a sudden, you know, I heard one of the waiters there telling people, you know, when they were asking, well, you know, can we have some more coffee? And they were like, well, you know, that's it. You know, we've brought out, you know, gallons of coffee, and we're told that, you know, that you've reached your limit. So I think the Navajo people can equal the firefighters in drinking coffee. So what else do you have for us, Noel?
Aside from the fire reporting, I also did a couple stories. There was the Miss Farmington Indian pageant that had taken place on June 13th, and a 14-year-old won that title, and her name is Shanoa Jones. And in order to compete for the Miss Indian Farmington title, the contestant has to be an enrolled member of a federally recognized tribe and be between the ages of 12 to 18 years old and reside in Farmington. And the pageant started in 2006, and the title holder represents this city's Native American community and also serves as a city ambassador. And that's what the Farmington Indian Center director, Myra Newman, told me. And so Shanoa, I was only able to observe the contemporary talent competition because the pageant itself started at 5:30, and with a 9 p.m. deadline, I could only stay for that portion. But Shanoa, as her contemporary talent, explained her interest in filmmaking. And so she used the PowerPoint presentation to display the steps she uses for editing and developing videos. And she showed some of her short movies she's made. And she also talked about how you can add music to these videos, and she demonstrated that. And one of the videos she completed was a commercial for a homemade soda product, and then the other was based on the Harlem Shake, and it was, I think it was, like, if I remember, five, like, Navajo kids in a hogan, and they were doing the Harlem Shake, and the audience really liked that one. They chuckled along. Anyway, Shanoa won the title, and she'll be serving for the next year as Miss Indian Farmington. And there were three other contestants, and they were all Navajo. One of them was named Deanne Lee, and she's 17, and she talked about reasons why she would like to join the military after graduating high school. She talked about, as part of her contemporary competition, she talked about a U.S. Marine Corps veteran named Minnie Spotted Wolf, and Minnie was the first Native American woman to enlist in the Marine Corps and was a member of the Blackfoot tribe. And,
wow.
And Deanne also talked about her grandfather's service in the Army, and the reason why she wants to join the military is to follow his footsteps, and she hopes to enlist after graduating from Farmington High School in 2015. And a unique aspect to this competition was you had two sisters competing. You had Catlin and Kayla O.J., and Catlin is 13, and she was the youngest contestant, and she demonstrated how you make flower pins, both the riding pin and a pin you can wear as a brooch.
Oh, yeah.
And, and she was just cute. She's all small, and she had this big table that they set up, and then she was up there explaining how you wrap the floral tape around the pin, and you attach the artificial flower to it, and she was just cute. I liked her. And then her sister Kayla is 16, and she talked about the science projects that she's done through the past school year, and one of them was focused on the level of sugar content found in Native foods. And so she talked about food like steamed corn and blue corn mush. And she also explained how you use the scientific method. You know, you come up with an idea, which is a hypothesis, and you figure out how to test that hypothesis, and you report your results. And so she explained that, and she cautioned the audience by saying, you know, Native foods, I know you guys love it, but you should have a minimum of it, because the results that she gathered showed that there's a high amount of sugar found in Native foods, and we know that in some cases, high level of sugar can lead to diabetes, which is, you know, a disease that impacts a lot of Native Americans. And
you know,
Kayla,
that issue is interesting, because 16-year-old is already talking about this,
mm-hmm.
and. That's just, you know, amazing. And I want to hear some more, but we're going to take a little break, Noelle, right now, and we'll get back with you right after this break. And I was talking with Noelle Smith of the Farmington Daily Times.
Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to Politics on the Navajo Nation with Marley Shabala, sponsored by CalNez Design. Blog Talk Radio, you're listening to Politics on the Navajo Nation with Marley Shabala, sponsored by CalNez Design. And now, back to Ms. Shabala.
Ya'at'e, Marley Shabala, yin shia, tohe glini and shlon, nashtetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetetet And once again, I'm going to give out our phone number, 347-989-0048. Please call in and comment. And I really want to hear from the people and find out if they, you know, I'd really like to talk to people who attended some of the Navajo Nation presidential forums, because I was unable to attend, but I hear a lot of different comments about the presidential forums. But I'd like to go back to talking with Noelle Smith. She's a news reporter with the Farmington Daily Times, and she was talking about a news story that she did on the Miss Indian Farmington. And it was great, the story that you were talking about regarding the two sisters. And what impressed me was the 16-year-old Kayla, who did a science project, and it was looking at the sugar content of native food. And that's an issue that is, I believe, not just here on Navajo, but across the country with other tribes, but also nationally. Do you remember that that movie that was made by, what was that film maker? And he did it on one of the fast foods. It was fast food something. Do you remember that, Noelle? And it was specifically about the content of food and how it's affecting individuals and weight and diabetes.
I think that documentary is called Fast Food Nation, but I cannot remember the filmmaker's name, but I could see the poster in my head of the movie. But I haven't watched the documentary, but I know it was addressing that issue of, I think, like, also questioning where exactly your food is coming from and how it reaches you. But
then you have the 14-year-old. Did you say that did the was already into filmmaking?
Right. The winner, Shanoa. Yeah, she's 14, and she's already dabbling in making short movies, and it's something that she's interested in, and I think the audience really enjoyed that she's at 14, you know, taking this interest, and I think she's using one of the Microsoft programs to help her edit her films, and she does kind of like what teens her age are interested in. So she had a short clip about Minecraft, which is that game you can play and build your own world, and she talked a little bit about that and why she wanted to focus on that as a short film project. And so I think I'm curious to see how she incorporates being Miss Indian Farmington into her filmmaking abilities, because I know the outgoing Miss Indian Farmington was Sarah Rose Duncan, and she showed a slideshow of her year in service, and I'm wondering if Chenoa will do the same at the end of her reign and make it a little more extensive, like documentary or something. So we'll find out next year when a new title holder is selected. And
what will they be doing then as Miss Indian Farmington?
They go out and make appearances at some of the local events and some of the regional events, like in terms of Sarah, I saw her at the Just Move It event. My first encounter with her was at the Just Move It event when it took place in Burke Park in Farmington. And, you know, she stood up there and explained that she's Miss Indian Farmington and the reasons why, you know, people should participate in Just Move It, which is to promote fitness and activity. And even if it's a minimum workout program, you know, 30 minutes a day is still beneficial. And she also, I think if I remember correctly, she helped lead a couple of little like warm-up exercises for the walkers before they left on the course, and which weaved throughout the park. And so they do that. They go out and they talk at the events, and they just represent Farmington as a member of the community, coming, you know, from the community, and that's their duty and their role, and they also represent the city's Indian Center. And I think they also, you know, try to teach a little bit about their cultural background. So in this case, Chenoa is Navajo, so she'll be talking about, I'm sure, some of the Diné teachings and some of the aspects of the culture. Go ahead.
I was going to say, you know, Farmington is one of the border towns, and it seems like, you know, that's a way for she's being the ambassador for Farmington, because it really does have a reputation for being racist, and I see it as an attempt, you know, to, you know, get over that hurdle and try to, you know, really reach out, and they're sponsoring this event, and Gallup, I think the only thing they have is the Intertribal Indian Ceremonial Princess, and I'm not sure if we could compare the two, but anyway, maybe we can ask Bill Donovan. Can you stay on the line, Noelle? And I'd like to have you, you know, make your comments or, you know, talk with Bill, and we have Bill here. Bill, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Good. All right. We have, for our listeners, we have Bill Donovan, and he has been on the, doing news coverage of the Navajo Nation. I'll let him tell you how many years he's been out here. And he's an editor for the Gallup New Mexico Independent newspaper, and he's also a correspondent for the Navajo Times newspaper, which is here in Window Rock, Arizona. So what do you have for us, Bill?
Marty, this is my 12th presidential election. 12 of them. That's a lot of presidential election candidates. But yesterday I interviewed Jeff Byrd, who is running as a Republican candidate against Benway Lujan for U.S. Representative in a district which includes all the Navajo Reservation in New Mexico. He did this 2 years ago, and he lost badly to Lujan. But he's trying again, and he's visiting Navajo chapters, even though the Republicans are outnumbered on the reservation, 5-1 by Democrats. He says he is very optimistic this time he will succeed. Now, it's kind of interesting because a few days before, I interviewed Dale E. Soce, who's from the Chi, who ran 4 years ago for tribal president, and he's running again. And like Lujan, like Bird, he feels he has a good chance of winning. What Soce's been doing now for the past several weeks is something that very few candidates for tribal president have been doing, and that is going door to door on the Navajo reservation, trying to get support. He says this is a lot better for him than going to chapter meetings, because when he goes and meets these people, they're so excited about a presidential candidate actually coming to their door and asking for their support that they have agreed to give him any support he needs and talk to their friends about him too. So he feels that this is a great way to campaign, and he wish he had done it 4 years ago. Now, I also talked to another candidate, Kenneth Maryboy, who is doing the more traditional stuff, which is going to chapter meetings, selling T-shirts to raise money for his campaign, and he's also meeting a lot of people. Now, he's better known than Soce, but he's saying that as he goes to some of his chapters that don't know him, they've heard about him, and he feels that this is a good chance for him to get his name known. Another candidate, Russell Begay, is doing something that is somewhat unusual, and that is he's got billboards set up all over the reservation and in the border communities. He's got one just outside Gallup with his big name in, and trying to get people to recognize him from that. One of the things he has done, which I thought was very interesting, was that he talked to people, and they said, well, when you put your billboard on, dress the same way as your billboard so people will recognize you. And he says that seems to be working, because wherever he goes anywhere, he wears the same shirt, the same necklace, and people recognize this and say, oh, there's the guy who's running for tribal president. And he feels that this is one way for him to get himself recognized. And some of the other candidates who are running for president all feel they have a good chance of winning because they're getting a very positive vibe from the Navajo people, who say they want someone out there who will represent them. They want change, and they want a candidate who will listen to them. And that, I think, is a very positive move on the Navajo reservation. Marley?
What's interesting about what you're saying, Bill, is when you say that the Navajo people, they want change, they want a tribal president to listen to them. And so how many press conferences have we had with President Shelley? How many did we have with President Shirley? How many did we have with President Begay?
I can count the number on one hand.
Yeah, there's not a good track record of the presidents meeting with a group of journalists, let alone one-on-one.
Yeah. But another thing is, every candidate promises, I will have an open-door policy. If you need something, come to my office and I will help you. That doesn't last very long.
Well, you know, every time I've gone over to the office of the president and vice president, I remember under President Shirley, there was actually a code that you had to put into the door before it would unlock.
Yes.
Lately, President Shelley, that door has been open, but who knows, he might close it because he claims that he got death threats because of rumors that he was taking the fire donations.
Well, every president, I think, has gotten death threats. That's why they have security. And the security goes
that's
with them
terrible.
Everywhere they go.
I don't remember when security started. Maybe I do.
It started with Peter McDonald.
Yeah.
Nakai didn't have security, but Peter McDonald did. And he had security. He had security. The other ones don't have this, but McDonald has security outside his house at night. There was a security officer who stayed up all night to make sure no one tried to break into McDonald's house.
You know what I remember, Bill? I remember during the height of the political dispute, and Peter McDonald was still in the office of executive offices, and the council was still trying to remove him, and he was changing the locks on the council door and having the tribal police come and evict them from their legislative branch offices. And I can't remember exactly what it was, but I remember going over to his offices because I was trying to contact him regarding passports. And so I drove up into the parking lot, and there was nobody around, and I knew that he was going to, he usually comes out of that side door. So I was waiting and waiting. And all of a sudden, this black limousine drives up really slow. The windows were dark. They were tinted dark. I couldn't tell who was in it, but it drove up really slow, and then it parked in the legislative office's parking lot. And so I'm watching this, and I'm wondering, who is that? And next thing you know, Peter McDonald comes, that door, side door flies open, and he runs out and jumps into his vehicle, and they take off. And I was wondering, who's in a limousine?
Yes, I've never seen a limousine on the reservation, yeah.
Yeah,
I want to tell you a story that got me in a lot of trouble when I was with covering Peter McDonald. I heard a story that he was going to, he had a design, the tribe's design office, come up with a design to build a tunnel from his office to the tribal council so he would not have to go out on the street, and he could go directly into the council. So he wouldn't have to take any risk of anybody trying to shoot him or something. And this was very serious for a time there, and they were going to do it until they found out how much it was going to cost. And at that point, they gave up on it.
That I don't know. That disturbs me. That our president, our chairman, would feel so afraid of the people. It just doesn't sit well with me. I don't understand that because. Back then, I don't know if what the statistics were looking like regarding the violent crimes. I don't remember them being so high back then as they are now. Do you know what I mean, Bill?
Yeah.
It doesn't seem like that was the behavior of the people.
No, it isn't, and it's very rare for anything like that to happen. When I've talked to security guards, they said that they're mainly there because sometimes it gets very tense in chapter meetings when the president or chairman was there, and they were afraid that it might turn into a situation where the chairman or the president could be in danger, and that's why they were there. Now, I know that when Shelley goes to the western part of the reservation, there are chapter meetings, like in Bottleway Gap, that are somewhat tense, and he feels it's safer to have a security guard there with him.
Well, you know, I know that you were chairman and president Peterson Zahm. He was one of the few I remember that would have these press conferences with the media. We would go to his office and he'd be sitting there and we'd look down the hallway and he'd have his door wide open and he'd look up and he'd motion for us all to come on down and sit in his office. And we'd shake his hand, and we'd have a nice little informal, round table with the media. Then his home burned down. Do you remember?
Yes.
I don't remember. I know that it burned down.
He just built it, and it burned down. He thought that someone who was anti-Zah did it.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, that's where you have one incident where, there was, who knows if it was, related to someone doing it, the people.
But
we never find
out who did it, so we never know.
What would your solution be for keeping that those presidential promises of I will listen to you, I will have an open door policy? Maybe we should have them sign a promise letter or something, huh, Bill?
That would help. But they'd probably break that promise letter. It's just impossible.
Well, you could attach it to something like, if you break this promise, then you'll have to do what? What do you think they should do if they break
your
promise?
How about, let's say, if you keep your promise, after 2 years, we will give you a raise.
That would work. You know, there has to be some kind of money incentive. And if they break it, then you can take away money that they have.
Yes.
Or what they do is to the tribal employees, isn't it, if they don't meet these certain standards, then they can't travel anymore.
Yes, they do that. They take away 20% of the travel money until they complete any kind of auditing violations.
That's a sanction, right?
It's a sanction, yes.
Okay.
Noelle, do you want to say something to Bill? Now's your chance. You got everybody listening in.
I just want to say hi, Bill. How are you doing?
Hi, Noelle. I haven't seen you for a while.
I know. Are you hiding out on purpose?
You cover San Juan County mostly, and the reservation. I'm usually in an hour times making phone calls.
So whose desk do you borrow now at the Navajo Times?
That's a major problem now because they got a lot of interns. So I have to go desk to desk now.
Oh, so you're desk hopping.
Yes, desk hopping. But I remember using your desk a few times when you were there.
A few times. Like, I knew Wednesday was here when Bill Donovan was sitting at my desk. But I didn't mind Bill.
Yeah, I know you did.
Yeah.
Hey,
you
Bill
always tell
and
me.
Noel, did you both cover the news event when New Mexico Governor Martinez and President Shelley went out to the Asai fire?
I was in the Nachiti chapter for a day, and I didn't see Noel, but I'm assuming she was somewhere there around there.
I saw them when they landed in the Black Hawk helicopter at Newcomb. I think they stopped there before going to Nachiti.
And so what did they have to say since you both covered it?
Well, when I talked to him, I didn't get a chance to talk to the governor. I talked to people connected with Shelley, and they were saying that Shelley's going to do anything he has to make sure that the people are not adversely affected by the fire. Well, we have to see if he actually does that or not.
Tuned into the governor here and there because once the helicopter landed and all the personnel got out, so you saw Governor Martinez exit the helicopter, followed by President Shelley and Vice President Rex Lee Jim. All the media personnel who were there immediately went to the governor and were surrounding her, and she was greeted by Central Consolidated School District Board President Lupita White, along with one of the top administrators from CCSD. I can't remember her first name, but I know it's Dr. Bekis. And they both spoke to Governor Martinez about Lupita White's case. She talked about how their, I think she said like her uncle's cabin was lost to the fire, and along with the family land that's up there in the mountain, and how emotional it was to see that loss happen, and how she was trying to get through that situation. And in terms of Dr. Bekis, she was explaining how the school district was donating the gymnasium and the school facilities for shelter purposes and also to house the firefighters. And so that was all going on, and I saw President Shelley off to the side, and he was talking to a constituent from Sheep Springs chapter about some of the sights he saw in the helicopter flyover they did of the fire. So once he finished talking to that individual, I asked Rose Whitehair, who was accompanying the president, if I could have a few minutes with Shelley, and she said that was fine. And so I talked to the president one-on-one, and he just mentioned that the fire wasn't like a one one flame kind of thing. I don't know how to explain it. It wasn't like affecting an entire area, like the, you know, they're saying 14,000 acres, and it wasn't the entire 14,000 acres being consumed. It was like these pockets and these patches of fire activity that was happening. And so that kind of clarified that for him, because, like, I think a lot of people were assuming that that whole entire 14,000 acres is gone, but it's not. It's, you know, certain areas that have had fire activity and certain areas that don't, and I think that's the nature of fires. They don't just, you know, wipe out everything in their path. For some reason, they bounce around. That's just science and nature, I think. So he talked about that, and I asked him what him and the governor had discussed it, and he said that, you know, the governor had offered, wanted to know what type of services at the state level she could provide the tribe. And so he said, you know, one thing that he would like to see is the increased presence of the New Mexico State Police on Highway 491, because there were reports of vandalism happening. So he wanted that increased, and then also that he just appreciated, you know, her coming out and wanting to see what they can do at the state level in order to help the tribe.
Speaking of 491, we got reports today that there has been some progress being made, and it appears that the road construction will continue without being abated.
Oh, because of the fire?
No, because the Shelley's people and the state people have gotten together and worked out their problem with the right-of-ways. So that seems to be no longer a problem.
I find that interesting, because when they made the announcement about 491 expanding, it sounded like everything was set in place and a done deal. And
yeah, Martinez said there's no way on earth that this will not go through this time. I remember that.
Okay. Make a mental note.
Yes. But
well,
Nora,
that,
I know that you, I know
yeah.
you missed the Navajo times. I know.
Well,
Bill,
why don't
you
tell listeners why 491 is important?
Yes. Oh, well, in some ways it's important to Gallup, because there's a feeling that 491 is completed, Navajos from the Shiprock area will start coming to Gallup in droves. Now, for the Navajo people, it's important because it's going to reduce the number of deaths on that highway. It's still a major problem. Because I remember back in the 1970s when I was traveling to Window Rock on 264, and it was a two-laner. And everybody was worried about driving that 264 during those days, because there were a lot of accidents, a lot of fatalities on that road. So everybody was glad when it's finally expanded to four lanes.
Mm-hmm. I think the interesting thing to kind of keep an eye out once 491 is expanded to four lanes is the speed limit. Will that increase or will it stay at 65? Because I've noticed traveling from Farmington to Gallup that the areas that have four lanes, people tend to go beyond 65, and in some cases I think they're going like 80 and 90. And even though, you know, there's two lanes going north and two lanes going south, you still have kind of a mixture of speeds happening. You have some people still going below the speed limit, some going at the speed limit, and you got these fast drivers, and you got semis on the road too. So it'll be interesting to see how that's handled.
Noelle, do you travel that road a lot?
I usually am on that road on the weekends, and if I have to travel to Window Rock for reporting, I'm on it.
Do you ever see Navajo Tribal Police patrolling it?
You know, this past weekend is probably the most activity I've seen by Tribal Police. I think I saw about two or three of their units traveling on the highway. But
hi,
I rarely
Bill.
See.
Hi, Noelle.
What?
It's Sharon. I just wanted to ask you, I didn't mean to interrupt you, do you remember back when this highway was North 666 and, you know, it did have a very high accident rate, and it was deemed the Devil's Highway, and it got a lot of notoriety, and, you know, I even saw a couple of, you know, supernatural programs about it. Bill, do you remember that?
I remember that. I remember the people saying that. if you change the number on it, it will get better, but it never did.
Yeah, and now, but go ahead.
I was going to say, I just remember when they converted from 666 to 491 in the mad dash to get all the 666 signs.
Exactly. I remember that, too. And it does seem, even though the accidents haven't improved so much, I do believe its notoriety has kind of died down. It doesn't seem like people are doing, you know, programs, TV programs about it so much anymore. I was going to ask about what in reference to the vandalism, talk a little bit more about that, Bill. That kind of went by. I just, what does that mean?
Okay, what are you talking about?
You said that they needed the policemen or the officers
to
patrol.
No, that was Noelle saying that. Noelle said
okay,
that.
Okay, Noelle, sorry. Sorry about
okay.
that. In reference to...
The Shelley asking that the state police presence increased.
Yes, uh-huh.
He mentioned that, you know, there were reports that maybe some of the residents that were evacuated could have been burglarized, but he didn't really elaborate too far from that. And, you know, we were also pressed for time, so I was trying to get as many questions, you know, asked to him for him to answer. And interview I had was with Rex Lee Jim, and he talked about how he was getting the word out that we need to say some prayers for the mountain and for the personnel who were up there fighting the fire, and he thought that was an important aspect to include in terms of addressing this fire situation.
That's good to know that our vice president was out there. I haven't seen him that often. Do you know what he's been doing, Bill? I see him
once
in a while at the council.
He's not spending a lot of time on the reservation. He travels a lot. And he travels, it's two areas are education and health. So he travels a lot to Washington and trying to get improvements for health, travels to places to improve the education. I've interviewed him maybe three times in total since he became vice president. He's always talked about his efforts to improve the situation by going to outside sources to bring in more help to the Navajos.
I know that you cover education, Noel. Are you seeing any of the benefits from the vice president traveling and talking about getting resources?
That's a good question. I would say that I'm not covering education as much because at the Daily Times we have an education reporter, and so he you know covers the various school districts here, and so my coverage of that has kind of slowed a bit to more of the.
Noel, are you covering the election very much?
We haven't really started it. We're going to probably start looking more and more into it in July because of the decision on that was because the primary election's until the 28th. But I've been, you know, keeping an eye on what news stories I see and then also what activity you see on Facebook in terms of the various presidential debates.
Have the presidential candidates been coming to you and asking for interviews?
Not so much. I haven't really. I've heard from Kenneth Maryboy's campaign. They send press releases, and the ones I've encountered so far, I've told them, you know, feel free to email me, you know, information and whatnot. Because there are 17 candidates, I think we're trying to handle it in a not to one-to-one interview basis, but more of kind of just sending out a questionnaire and having them answer that.
Marty, I told you last week I was trying to work on a story about the women candidates running for tribal council. I hit a major roadblock. I had trouble getting the numbers for the presidential candidates from the election office, but I finally succeeded. When I went to the election office to get the telephone numbers for the council delegates, I got turned away. They said they would not give me any and that they had to call the candidates themselves. And I tried to explain to them the candidates would want the publicity, but the election office wouldn't do it, even though I told them also I thought this was public information.
You know, Bill, I have the same problem, too. I requested the contact information from the election office, and they sent me the Northern Agency stuff, which is, you know, my focus, but all they sent me were, like, the mailing addresses, so it's all P.O. boxes on there.
Yes.
And when I asked about, you know, telephone numbers and email addresses, they told me, well, it's optional if the candidate wants to supply that information, so that's why they gave me all the mailing addresses.
Yeah. And off reservation now, you can go on a website, the New Mexico State, the Secretary of State's office, and get all of this information, mailing addresses,
mm-hmm.
telephones, everything.
Mm-hmm. Then I think Marley and I had a discussion about how the variation between how the states operate their elections and the tribal, as far as, you know, campaign finances, a state and county election, you can see the finances more frequently as opposed to the tribe. I mean, interesting that it's like that with the contact information for candidates.
These are public servants, and they're running for a public office, and they're making all these public promises, and that's the first step in transparency, in listening to your constituents. How can you listen to your constituents if your constituents can't even call you on the phone or, you know, email you or do anything like that? Hello?
Yeah. That's one of the problems. But people didn't want people to phone them. One of the big differences from this election than in previous elections is that almost everybody now has a cell phone. Especially if you're a younger person. And off reservation, they have this system whereby candidates make a recording and they call you. Now, I don't see any candidates doing that yet on the narrow reservation, but several of them have said that they've been trying to think of a way of doing it. They're trying to think of a way of getting in contact with the numbers that are located on the reservation, and they just haven't figured out how to do that yet.
Well, that needs to be not an optional. That should not be an option for any of the political candidates or for any of the public servants on the Navajo Nation, and that includes your chapter officials, your grazing official, farm boards. There should be phone numbers where the constituents can reach them and talk to them. Especially, you know, there's going to be public hearing regarding the proposed Rangeland Improvement Act, and that deals with a highly controversial issue, which is grazing permits, livestock. And I remember reporting on a meeting that they had down in Phoenix on it, and people were outraged. And now they want public comment via Internet. And if you don't get your comment in by June 30th, then you can give a verbal comment at the public hearing on June 30th at Dinette College in Taylor, Arizona. But you're going to be limited to 10 minutes. And what do you think the age limit is, or age grouping category, for those grazing permittees, Bill?
I assume that it'd be the older Navajos. Probably,
yeah, so how many of them are going to be on the Internet and be able to use, you know?
I would say about maybe 0.5% or 1%.
and that's what I mean, you know. It's there seems to be this, they've lost touch with how to communicate with their constituents, with the Navajo people, our elected officials. And it goes back to these public hearings, and it comes right back to where we started talking about how do you contact your elected official. And these are, right now, they're political candidates. And I agree with both of you that, hey, you know, this is a free campaign ad for them. And you're trying to explain that to the election office?
I don't see any candidates being upset at it. Getting them giving us their phone number. So.
Yeah. Cause,
and you know what? It would be interesting to find out which of those political candidates have specifically asked the election office, don't give out my phone number. That's what we should go over there and ask.
I didn't ask. I should ask that too, yeah.
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 That's a good idea.
Find out. Because I know that the Speaker Pro Tem, Lorenzo Bates, when he was a council, well, he still continues to be a council delegate. But, you know, I have his phone number. You have his phone number, Noelle?
Yes, I do.
What about you, Bill?
Somewhere.
But the point is, you have it, right?
Yes.
And this is his cell number.
Yes.
I don't have the president's cell phone number or Rex Lee Jim.
No. I have a cell number for Stop AIDS.
I don't want to talk. You know, that's the thing with news reporters. We're always told to go to the source.
Mm-hmm.
And in this case, it's the president, you know. And we had that problem with George Hardeen when President Shelley was in office. Remember, we just, you know, had to keep saying, well, you know, we want to do an interview, you know, and he would respond, you know, make a statement on behalf of President Shirley, and our editors would say, no, you know, we're not going to use George Hardeen's statements. And I don't, you know, we shouldn't have to.
No, but Shirley would agree to maybe one interview at the end of the year, and maybe one or two other ones, but he wasn't very happy about press conferences.
Noel, how did you do? Did you ever interview Shirley, President Shirley?
I
shouldn't call him Shirley.
No, I never.
Well, you know what?
I never interviewed him.
Did you get anything from his press officer, Bill? I know that.
Which one are you talking about?
The,
which president you talked about?
Oh,
now?
President Shirley, George Hardeen.
Yes.
Yeah.
I talked to George a lot, yes.
But I don't know if he copied you in it, and Dwayne was editor at that time, Bial, when I was working for the Navajo Times. But I remember he sent me an email, and he kept pushing for us to use Dr. Shirley, or Navajo Nation President Dr. Shirley.
Yes,
and
which
then
he never
also
did.
Put in there that, he didn't want me to, in second reference, to use Shirley. He said, use Dr. Shirley and or President.
Yeah, but
when
this came up, I said the policy is you only use a doctor if it's a medical doctor and he's talking as a medical doctor.
Mm-hmm. That's what the AP style book dictates.
And for our listeners, the AP style book is the Associated Press style book. You know, so there are standards for journalists that are set. And that's something I think that news media, we're always having to deal with the public information officers, and never directly with the elected officials. And people
should really start
asking those political candidates for their cell phone numbers.
Yeah.
Well, that's what I've been doing.
That's a problem we have everybody. I mean, I don't have any of the U.S. representatives or senators, but I have all their aides' cell phone numbers.
Maybe a new trend needs to start.
Well, especially here on the Navajo Nation, I know that some of the public information officers try to make it sound like the president is at the same level as the president of the U.S., meaning that there's millions of people trying to contact him, so we can't give out the cell phone.
No. But pretty much, I would put the president of the tribe on the same level as a governor of a small state.
Yeah, and you know, Governor Martinez comes out, does she have security with her?
She has state police or something like that.
State police, huh? What about Governor Brewer, Arizona?
I've never met her.
Me either.
I know, but that's one thing that we need to start doing, as I think.
Has Governor Brewer ever been to the Navajo Nation? I can't recall.
I have never seen her here.
Because, yeah, most of the times when I see her interacting with the elected officials from the tribe, it's usually in Phoenix. Hmm. Interesting.
And that's when they have, what is it, at the Capitol? What do they call that? Indian Day?
Is it Indian Day?
Native American Day?
During the state legislature?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Utah has one, too. I think most of the states do. And you're right. It would be. You know what? I think a lot of people, this comment about only seeing their elected officials when it's campaign time, is so true. I wish that our council delegates would go door to door. I would like to see open my door and there would be, a council delegate or even President Shelley.
It's not going to happen.
We can dream. But then again, Noelle might not like, those elected officials knocking on her door and knowing where she lives.
I was thinking more about you. I was thinking, which one would it be? It would be like a holiday for Marley because she could ask all the questions, but
they probably
political
be
person would be like,
"It's my
greatest,
God, I'm at Marley Jabala's house."
But then they would get insight into the mind of Marley Jabala if they were invited in for coffee or tea.
Yeah, then I'd really have be a target there, for sure. No, I'm just kidding. But it would be so amazing if our elected officials would go door to door and just talk with the people and let the people talk with them at that level instead of expecting the people to stand up when they come into a room. I hope
Shelley's going to have a meet and greet here in Gallup sometime in July or early August. And what you're going to do is it's going to be at Sammy's restaurant here in Gallup. You're going to have to pay a cover charge to get in. But that cover charge will allow you to have a little bit of a meal and talk to the president. So this is a campaign fundraiser.
Do you also get his autograph?
You could probably do that, yes.
That's what we need. We need the president's autograph. But who knows, that might be. Anyway, I'm not going to go anywhere with that right now. But that would be interesting. I wonder if he's going to let people take pictures with him too then.
Yeah, I think he's going to let people take pictures. I'm just kind of wondering how many people actually show up once they realize that. I think it's like $5 or $10 cover charge. As compared to the other fundraisers he's had in Gallup, where you had to pay $100 a plate.
So how many people showed up, and what did he do?
He's had, on the $100 plate, he's had 200 or 300 people at a time show up. But most of them were like division directors, people who depend on Shelley's reelection for their jobs.
Political appointees.
Political appointees, yes.
That serve at the pleasure of President Shelley.
And I kind of wondered on this. I heard that there were some Anglos going to it. There's $100 a plate dinners, and I kind of wondered if that was a violation of tribal law, because the law says that no non-Navajos can donate to Navajo candidates during an election. So I was wondering if that was a violation as well.
That is. If those same laws are still on the books, it is a violation.
They're on the books.
Yeah, it is. And that's why I've talked so often about the filing of campaign financial statements by all of the Navajo Nation elected officials and all of the Navajo Nation political candidates. And there's an ethics codes regarding receiving of gifts. There's a certain limit that you have. And I think that probably those limits have been reached because of the number of times that I've seen the gaming or the gambling, you know, gambling regulatory office, the gambling enterprise come in and feed the council.
Yeah, they do that on a regular basis, yes.
And all the reports are done in executive session.
Yeah.
So this is a tribal enterprise, and I don't know what they're doing, really.
When I do talk to them, they tell me repeatedly that they are under certain laws, both federal and tribal, about what they can report as far as finances are concerned.
Yep. So what's happening with Speaker Nays?
He's trying to decide now whether to take his case to the Supreme Court.
Have you heard anything, Noel?
I heard roughly the same, that there maybe it could be appealed to the Supreme Court.
So what is he trying to appeal for our listeners to give them an update? I think that many of our listeners, the last piece of the last news they had was that they were in court. He was filing for a restraining order, and then it was going into peacemaking, and then the council didn't want to go into peacemaking because they felt that they had been talking all this time since January, when the charges were filed against him in December, asking him to temporarily step down and go take care of the criminal charges against him, and that, you know, he could retain his position during that time as speaker, and once the charges were cleared up, then he would come, you know, he would come back and everything would be, you know, fine. You know, but then again, if he had found guilty, then they would remove him. But that's
right.
The point where it stopped. So what happened at that point? It went into court. There was a decision that was going to be issued. That decision was made?
That decision was made. Now, he argued that the decision by the Navajo Nation Council did not follow proper procedure. Remember in the first resolution that Mr. Shepherd, Alton Shepherd, presented to the council, he wanted to remove him as speaker, but allow him to stay on as a council delegate. Well, somewhere along the process, the second time, they amended that and said, no, we won't put you on administrative leave with pay. Nays's attorney argued that that was illegal because when you amend something, you only amend a portion of it, and you don't change it completely. Well, the Supreme Court said, no, that's not true. The procedures followed by the tribal council was proper, and it was lawful, so therefore he would remain on administrative leave with pay. So they're going to take that issue to the Supreme Court now.
Mm-hmm. I was at the court hearing when the arguments were made, and speaker's attorney. Well, what was his name?
He's from Colorado.
Brian Lewis.
He was arguing the laws. He said there were. He pointed to two sections of the Navajo law and said that this didn't. There was no law that allowed the council to place the speaker on administrative leave. But then the attorneys for the council, which was the Navajo Department of Justice, and that included Attorney General Harrison Soce, they argued that there was law, that there was Navajo law, and they pointed to Diné fundamental law. And they went into a very lengthy explanation of basically what happens in peacemaking court, what it calls for, which is talking everything out, that you sit down and you really make an effort to talk and resolve conflict. And they said that that's what they tried to do. And they pointed to before the council, that there were council delegates on the floor that had, during the debate of placing Speaker Nays on administrative leave, during that debate, several of the council delegates made reference to meetings that they had one-on-one with Speaker Nays or as groups with Speaker Nays in trying to have him step down because he had lost his good standing because of the criminal charges. And then they also talked about what it meant to be a leader, a Navajo leader. And they also spoke about when Chairman McDonald was removed. Do you remember that, Bill?
I remember. He was also placed on administrative leave with pay.
And at that time, there was actually no law dealing with the removal or the placing the chairman on administrative leave, especially when at that time Chairman McDonald had the council delegate him pretty much almost, yeah, he did. Somehow he was able to get the council delegate him all of their authority because he presided over them as chairman.
Yes. And the
yeah, he was
the
only one
said,
that could, you know, draft legislation and sponsor it. He appointed the committees. I mean, he even selected the committee, the chairperson, vice chairperson. He had a special committee, remember, the advisory committee that could act in an emergency in place of the council?
And I remember the argument at that time was, with the Supreme Court was, if the council gives you authority, the council has the right to take away that authority, and that's what they did.
And they talked about that. They talked about those arguments. And that decision by the Windorot District Court also went before the Supreme Court, and it was reaffirmed.
Yes.
So based on that, I don't think that Speaker Nays is going to have the decision by the Windorot District Court overturned, and he's going to remain on administrative leave.
Well, I think so, too, but I think he's going to try.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And so...
Well, I thought it was also interesting in the Supreme Court decision. They spent several pages talking about the 11 members of the council just walking out and not voting. And
right.
I thought this was not Navajo tradition, that because you're supposed to stay and you're supposed to try to work out your problems. You don't just turn your back on them.
Not only that, I mean, Judge Carol Perry, who issued the decision for the Windorot District Court, I mean, she added that, you know, the Navajo people trust their elected leadership to participate in those proceedings and not, you know, walk out because of a personal difference in a sense, you know? I thought that was interesting in reading the order she issued.
Yeah. You can tell
yeah,
she was
that
upset.
Is true. Yeah. Absolutely. Well, you know what? It is 8:59, and we have 1 minute to sign off here, folks. And I really want to say thank you to Noelle Smith from the Farmington Daily Times, and you'll be hearing from her next week. And also thanks again, Bill Donovan, from the Gallup Independent and the Navajo Times newspaper. And I want to say thank you to all of our listeners.
Blog Talk Radio. You've been listening to Politics on the Navajo Nation with Marley Shabala, sponsored by CalNez Design. Thank you all for joining us.